He had certain affinities with you, through your common father, and he is already subject to their influence. If you just desire to visit the palace at Pasaikhad, do so now. Draw around this earthly body of yours the signs used by the Master Jalaluddin, that it may rest safely till your return. Then go forth in your spirit form, and judge for thyself if I have shown you truly the nature of this woman whom you hast so madly loved. Go, and your servants shall go with you. The voice ceased, and I took up mechanically the black wand that I carried always with me, and traced out upon the floor the protecting circles. Then wrapping myself in my mantle, I laid my body down as though to rest, while in my heart there was the most fierce tumult of emotions, and in my soul, the chill despair of my dead hopes, the fearful agony of withered love. Chapter 25. My revenge. For the first time in my experience I was fully conscious of the process by which a spirit can leave the earthly envelope to roam untrammeled through the earth plane. As I withdrew myself from my mortal covering, I felt like one who throws off a cloak, and after two or three slight tremors of the muscles, I stood forth in my spirit form, free from my material body, save for a fine thread of gossamer-like texture, which attached me to it, and kept it animated by my life fluid. In all my previous experiences, I had been unconscious during the change, and had awakened, as one who wakes from sleep, to the knowledge of my spiritual surroundings. But on this occasion it was though I had stepped forth upon a new stage of life, and as I did so had withdrawn the curtain, which veiled its scenes and actors from my mortal sight. Around me I perceived the spiritual counterparts of all material things, but they no longer appeared as they had done to my mortal sight. Some were infinitely more beautiful, others had lost all trace of their earthly beauty, by reason of their spiritual defilement. My own body, as it lay before my eyes, looked as I was wont to see myself, but it appeared veiled by clinging cobwebs, like garments dipped in some scorching corrosive fluid, and stained with mud, and on looking at my spirit form, I perceived that I was clothed in a like manner, while the haggard wildness of my features had been transferred from the clay-like image of myself upon the ground to the living, suffering spirit. I passed my hand across my brow, to clear my brain and steady my wavering thoughts, then willing that I should visit Zuleika, I felt myself rise and rush through the air. As I hurried onward, I beheld around me, above and below, myriads of strange beings of every shape and kind. Those phantasmal creatures I had beheld so dimly before were distinct and clear to my vision now, spirits like unto myself. Human in their forms and in their natures, some bright as radiant angels, others dim and arc and full of woe. All around me, on every side, were multitudinous forms of life, man, beast, and bird, fishes and reptiles, plants, flowers, all like and unlike to those of material life. Stars glowed above me, lights flashed up and down, all was rush and hurry and turmoil, and there was neither rest nor peace anywhere. Like the waves of a mighty ocean, the life of the astral plane surged to and fro. As I rushed onwards, I saw that I was accompanied by a great train of spirits, weird creatures of phantom shapes, and the human spirits of dead men and women of evil lives. Onward with me they rushed, howling, shouting, crying, yelling out wild imprecations and fierce cries for vengeance upon all mankind, gesticulating like a set of maniacs, fighting with each other like a pack of wolves, laughing and screaming in fiendish joy at the thought of the sport which awaited them, waving their long, skinny arms to cheer me on, and mouthing at me with their hideous faces, shrieking curse upon each other and upon me, even while each one struggled to get the foremost place beside me, that they might the more enjoy the expected scene. Above all this wild throng I saw the floating form of the dark angel, poised upon his outspread wings like a majestic bird of prey, who watches the battle from afar that he may swoop down only to carry off the spoil, which others have gathered for him. And as the tide floats driftweeds onward upon its restless bosom, so were I and my wild escort floated on upon the current of my fierce and murderous desires. We reached the palace and city of Pasaikhad, and hung like a black cloud over it for one brief moment, ere we all sank down through roofs and walls, which no longer offered any obstruction to our passage. We entered the outer court, which led to my own apartments, and passed along the passage to that inner chamber where Zuleika had slept in my arms so many times. At the door I paused, and like a rushing torrent that meets with an obstruction in its path, the rush and hurry of my feverish thoughts seemed checked. I could not enter. The memory of our past love, the thought of all the sweetness of those vanished hours rose up as a barrier between me and my revenge. The goodness and purity, the faith and trust, of the dead past, were like white angels with outstretched wings to bar the way against sin and murder. I paused. I wavered for a moment in my wild thirst for vengeance. I half turned back, and dropped the curtain I had begun to draw aside. Another moment and my good angel would have conquered, and I should have left my meditated deed undone. But at this critical moment, while the scales trembled in the balance, the voice of Zuleika, of my faithless wife, fell upon my ears, speaking in soft dulcet tones fond words of love unto my rival. With a furious cry of wrath I tore aside the curtain from the doorway, and looked in. There she sat, attired as I had seen her in the vision in my tent, the jeweled circlet in her hair, the rich dress, the sparkling gems, the king's ring upon her finger, all exactly as I had seen it. And now upon her face there was the evil, seducing smile. The shameless glance of the temptress was in her eyes, and she looked as I had seen her first in Jalal ad-Din's mirror. And Selim sat beside her. His arms encircled her. His lips were pressed to hers, again and yet again, his passionate kisses. I could bear no more. With frantic haste I rushed upon them, forgetting that as a spirit I was invisible, and all my angry words inaudible. Me they saw not, but a violent trembling seized the king. A cold wind as of ice enveloped Zuleika, and she drew back from her lover in a sudden alarm. I tried to grasp the king. I tried to strangle him. But to my astonishment my hands made no impression upon him. It was as though I had become an intangible shadow myself. My hands glided off his body, as though the protecting armor of his material form offered an impervious wall against all my attacks. I drew my dagger, or rather the spiritual counterpart of the dagger, which I usually wore. My dagger was like myself, a shadow, beside the strong covering of the material shell. Furious with helpless rage, I stamped upon the ground, and to their ears, muffled by the flesh, my steps gave out no sound. Fear filled both their hearts, but it was a nameless fear of the unknown. In my hot anger I called aloud for some power to aid my vengeance, and the mocking laughter of the dark angel answered me, as he said, "Oh, fool, fool! To think that you, as a spirit, couldst penetrate the thick armor of mortality. But behold those who can, see whom I have sent unto your aid." A cloud enveloped us all, a cloud as black as the darkest storm cloud of night, as dense as a stream of filthy black mud. And in the midst of its darkness I beheld strange hideous gigantic forms. Frightful creatures like human apes, their hands like giant hands, their arms like flails, their bodies short and misshapen, like some fearful abortions of human birth. These creatures wrestled and fought as they enshrouded us with their foul dark atmosphere, and then the foremost of them grasped the king with a grip of iron, and strangling him in an instant, as a dog would kill a rat, flung his quivering body upon the ground at Zuleika's feet. And like a wave of darkness the foul creatures were gone as suddenly as they had come. Fierce as had been my desire for revenge, I shuddered at the horrible scene, and scarce conscious of anything but the horrible face of the murdered king, I rushed away from the fatal spot. Chapter 26. I am proclaimed king. It was well that I returned so quickly to my earthly body, for I found that a horrible-looking low earth-bound spirit was already touching it, and striving to take possession. The protecting ring of astral fire had died out in one place, and through this gap the dark spirit had entered. In my wrath I rushed forward, almost annihilating the wretched creature with the withering scorn of my glance, and he cowered down abjectly at my feet and slunk away, while I, re-entering my body with a violent and painful shock, awoke with the feeling of having dreamed some dreadful nightmare vision. And it was some moments before I collected my thoughts sufficiently to realize that my late experience had been no dream, but a dread reality. While I was thinking over what had passed, I heard a hurried whispering outside my tent, then the curtain was raised cautiously and someone looked in. With an exclamation of pleasure, I sprang up, for I recognized my father's faithful friend Al-Zulid. I had sent a messenger to him when I left Pasaikhad, but I had not hoped that he would meet me so soon, and after the terrible adventure of the last hours his presence was doubly welcome, for I had resolved to confide all to him, and to be guided by his counsel. He greeted me with much affection, and heard with a sympathy very welcome to my sore heart the story of my wrongs, and of the vengeance I had already exacted for them in so strange a manner. Said I not unto you to beware of Artemisia? Did I not warn you, Ahensimen, not to trust them for an hour? Verily do I believe that the queen had had a large share in the accomplishment of your dishonor, and of a truth, you and I shall pay off together the debts we owe her. But it will not be wise to let others know that you hast in effect slain the king. We must act as though we believed him still to be alive, and it will be time enough to speak of him as dead when others shall tell us of it. You dost not believe that he is dead? That I have seen him die even as I tell you? I think, friend, that you hast had a troubled dream, mayhap. Perchance it may be even as you sayest, but till I know from others that Selim had died, and died even as you sayest, I cannot well believe so strange a thing. Think not that I despise your vision. Frown not so angrily upon me, son of my dead master, for I do not doubt you hast seen something. The gifts of divination are your by right of birth, even as the throne of Persia shall be your, but I think that your agitated frame of mind may have colored your vision, and given it a more extreme ending than had belonged to it in truth. But come, you art awake now. The time for dreams is past, and if you wouldst avenge upon Artemisia your own wrongs, and those of your parents, we must lose no time. Prince Arnad is with me, and so are our followers, for we were on the march to Pasaikhad when your messenger met me, and I turned aside to seek you. Come and see Arnad with me, for he had dreamed of reigning, since you wouldst not take your father's place, and he will not much like to resign his dreams in your favor. Yet must he even do so, for you art first your name comes before his, and I swore to El-Jazid that should I find Ahensimen yet in life I would devote all my influence, all my power to place you, the favored son, upon the throne of Persia. I thank you, Al-Zulid, said I, grasping his hand with much emotion. You art indeed the truest of true friends, but cannot we arrange with Ahmed so that he shall not be wholly disappointed? Cannot we share the kingdom? Cannot he and I reign each over a part? In unity, not in enmity. I confess that I do now desire to reign. Love is dead for me. But ambition may yet be my god and power my idol. I may still seek in public life the solace of distinction. Persia shall be my mistress, since I have now no wife, and care for the greatness of my country shall fill the void left in my heart. Besides, added I, grinding my teeth with rage, besides that, have I not my revenge still incomplete? Shall I not grasp at power that I may wrestle upon more equal terms with Artemisia? Her son is dead, whether you durst believe it or not, for I have seen him die, but he is only one, and they who have wronged me were three. Lead me to your troops, and to Prince Ahmed, and what seems wise and right I will do, for I must no more delay to take up the heritage, which is mine by right of birth and deed of gift. Good, Ahensimen, King of Persia. But it must not be you who dost seek Ahmed. He must come to you, and I will bring him hither. So saying he went forth, and presently returned accompanied by Ahmed and the principal officers of his army, as well as the vizier Babajul. My tent was lighted only by a small lamp, but a light watch fire burned outside, and as Al-Zulid held back the curtains of my tent, its rays fell full upon my face and figure. As I stepped forth to meet Ahmed, and to assure him that my desire was to divide the kingdom with him, not to claim the whole for myself, the light from the fire illuminated my features and Babajul and the generals with him, who had known my father well, uttered an exclamation of surprise, for the likeness to my dead father, not alone in feature and figure, but in gesture and speech, was so strong they could almost have believed it was El-Jazid himself who stood again before them. Only it was like El-Jazid as he had been in youth, ere care had furrowed his brow and sorrow dimmed the luster of his eyes and the pride of his carriage. As for Ahmed, he regarded me in sullen astonishment and anger. He refused my proffered hand, and bowing haughtily said, "I cannot share the kingdom with you. It is mine or it is your, but I at least will have no divided inheritance. I will owe to the courtesy and policy of no man the power, which must be mine by right or not at all. I withdraw myself and my claims since Ben Al-Zulid and Babajul have found you, who are named before me in my father's decree. But I claim for myself perfect freedom of action. I will owe no allegiance unto you." Then turning upon his heel he strode from the tent, and mounting upon his horse rode away. As soon as he was gone, the others crowded around me, each eager to assure me of their fidelity, and then Al-Zulid advised that we should go forth, and that I should show myself unto the troops, to whom he had already explained who I was, and why he had turned aside from his march to meet me. Among the soldiers, and with the populace in Persia, Ben Al-Zulid was a great power. He was a favorite with everyone. His powerful physique, his splendid military talents, his undaunted courage, his success as a commander, all contributed to make him popular with the warlike people, while his unswerving fidelity and his noble nature won him the trust and confidence of all whom knew him. I verily believe that had he chosen to grasp the regal scepter for himself, instead of for me, he would have been elected to the throne with acclamations of joy. As it was, when he led me forth mounted upon my favorite horse and surrounded by the generals who had led the army of my late father through so many successful campaigns, and presented me to the assembled troops as the true king, appointed by Al-Jazid himself to succeed him, there went up a great shout of "Long live the King Ahrin Zeman! Long life to the son of Al-Jazid! Down with Queen Artemisia and her feeble son! Long may a king reign who can restore the fading glory to Persia!" The day was breaking and the red rays of the rising sun flashed redly upon the waving spears and nodding plumes of the great cavalcade of warriors before me, as the whole army collected by Al-Zulid shouted forth my name and greeted me as their new king, and for one brief moment, the triumph of my ambitious desires seemed as a solace to my wounded heart, and the first sip from the cup of power, sweet to my lips. And then there rose before my eyes again the vision of Zuleika, as she had hung so fondly on my rival's breast and whispered her words of love to him, till he changed into the horrible, distorted, hideous corpse I had seen lying at her feet. Then did all my thoughts of triumph turn to dust and ashes, all my exultation to bitterness, all the sweetness of the cup of prosperity to gall and wormwood, even as I tasted that first sip. I bowed as one in a dream. I bowed mechanically in answer to the ringing cheers, and as Al-Zulid gave the order to resume the march to pass Aghad, he put his hand upon the bridle of my horse, and bending down his head, whispered, "Awake, awake, Ahrin Zeman. Leave your dreams of love and disappointment behind you, for a new life, the life of action and of power, lies before you, and it shall bring consolation even for a woman's fickle smiles. It is the time to act, not to dream of that dread past of your affections." Chapter 27. I enter my capital. When Zuleika recovered from the first shock of dismay and horror at seeing the lover she was caressing die in so sudden and so unaccountable a way, in so terrible a manner, her first thought was of the danger to herself at being found with the dead body in her sleeping chamber. She had seen nothing of me, or of those horrible phantoms who had killed Selim. She thought he had died in convulsions. She felt a dim belief that I was in some way responsible for the catastrophe, but she had no idea that I had been actually in the room. What to do, she did not know. She could not touch Selim's body now, fond as she fancied she had been of him 10 minutes before. Neither dare she leave it where it lay, to be found in her room by Artemisia. Trembling and sobbing she sought out the trusty slave who had tended her from a child, and who had brought to her first the knowledge of the king's admiration when she was at Herat. To this woman she related what had happened, and after a short conference it was agreed that Selim's body should be taken through the secret passage by which he had entered Zuleika's room, and laid upon his own bed, there to be discovered by his own attendants, who would fancy he had died suddenly in the night. Zuleika and the faithful slave dared not summon anyone to aid them in their task, but fortunately the slave was a large, powerful woman, while the king, though tall, was a slender man, and not heavy, so that while the woman carried the poor contorted body in her arms, Zuleika, with much fear and trembling, helped to support it, and between them they carried it through the short passage and laid it upon the bed. They then shut the secret doors, and Zuleika, who was by this time almost in hysterics, was laid upon her own couch and tended by the faithful slave, who kept all others away from the bedside, that the state of Zuleika's mind, her wild weeping and great terror, should arouse suspicion. Thus did the night pass, and with early morning the king's death was discovered by one of the attendants, who ran in great alarm to call the queen. Consternation reigned everywhere. As for Artemisia, she was like a tigress that had been robbed of her young. In her frantic grief she hung over the dead body of her son, and refused to believe that he could be dead. She kissed the poor swollen, livid lips, she caressed the senseless head, she strove to straighten the twisted limbs, to warm the icy body by contact with her own passionately throbbing heart. She held her dead child in her arms, and rocked him on her bosom, as though he were still the infant upon whom she had lavished all her love, and to whom she had turned in her slighted affection. She turned like a wild beast upon all who tried to touch the dead man, or draw her away from him. For hours she continued her wild, useless efforts to restore him, forgetting, fortunately for Zuleika, all else, in her attempts to revive her son. Then, at last, the full measure of her woe broke upon her mind, and with a mad shriek of grief, a frantic cry of despair, she sank insensible upon her son's body, while the wild wail of her attendant maidens rent the air in lamentations over the dead Selim. It was by this time late in the afternoon. I and my troops had reached the palace of Parsekhe'ud. We had met the messenger sent by Selim to recall me, and his presence gave me a good pretext for entering the city quietly, without appearing to know aught of what had befallen the king. We met no opposition anywhere, scarcely did our appearance excite surprise. The awful events in the palace filled the public mind, to the exclusion of all other things. Everywhere were scattered groups talking over the strange death of Selim, the news of which had spread like wildfire through the city. Even when we reached the palace gates, no one opposed our entrance. When I showed the keepers of the gates the order for my return, Benazulid had turned very pale when he heard the news of Selim's death, and had exchanged a hurried glance with me. But he was careful not to betray our previous knowledge, and we rode into the courtyard of the palace unopposed, amidst a throng of bewildered soldiers and courtiers. Not with cries of joy was my coming welcomed, but as I drew near to the palace door, there fell upon our ears the long, wild lamentation, the mournful cry of the queen's women, as they raise the death wail over the murdered king. Chapter 28, My Wife. A short conference took place between Al-Zulid and the leaders of the late government. The decree of El-Jazid was exhibited to them, and it was made plain to the minds of Artemisia's friends that I had behind me a power strong enough to support my claims. The death of Selim left no pretext for opposing my elevation, and whatever might be the secret feelings of those about Selim's court, it was evidently not thought wise to display any animosity towards me. Moreover, I was not without friends, even among the late king's courtiers, and these all hoped to share in my prosperity. Thus was my elevation to the throne accomplished without any violent opposition, and even Artemisia herself had no excuse for interfering with me. The obsequies of Selim were conducted with much splendor, as is the custom in the East. Artemisia, who was still half frantic in her grief, remained unmolested in her own apartments, attended by her women, and unaware of my arrival, since I shrank from intruding upon her at such a time, and resolved to defer my revenge against her till a more fitting season, merely ordering that she should not be allowed to leave the palace. Zuleika I had not seen. She also was in effect a prisoner. She had heard with wonder, not unmixed with alarm, of the strange events which were taking place, and of my sudden elevation to power. Her first thought was regret that she had not been faithful to me. Her second, relief in remembering that I was in all probability ignorant of her falsehood. And as she recovered a little from the shock of Selim's death, she began to consider how best to turn the unexpected change to her own advantage. She wondered that I had not come at once to see her, as she felt sure my first impulse would have been under ordinary circumstances. She felt somewhat uneasy at my strange absence, but hoped it might be due to other causes than displeasure. She wished she had not been quite so angry with me when we parted, and at last resolved to send word to me, to ask if I had forgotten Zuleika. Meantime she had attired herself in her simplest yet most becoming manner, and removed as far as possible all traces of her late agitation. I had only just awakened from a short sleep of utter exhaustion when Zuleika's message was brought to me, and it was some minutes ere I realized all the changes which had taken place. When I did so, my anger against my faithless wife revived in all its bitterness. As I entered the room, Zuleika, who was resting upon her cushions, hurried forward with much show of delight to greet me. It was early morning, and she was but half dressed. Her beautiful hair hung loose upon her shoulders, her white round arms and neck were bare, and her pretty feet were thrust hastily into her slippers. Her dark eyes looked unusually large and wistful by reason of the paleness of her face. Her hands trembled as she strove to gather her veil around her and fasten her robe, but she turned to me with a smile as sweet and innocent as of old, and put out her arms caressingly to embrace me. But I drew back from her haughtily, and looked at her coldly and sternly, even while my heart gave a wild throb of anguish, and I would have given all the earth to know she was yet true to me and that all the terrible past was but an awful dream. My voice choked and trembled as I said to her, "You forget. It is not your husband, Ahensimen, who has returned to you, but the king of Persia. What did you desire of him?" Zuleika's arms dropped to her sides, and her large childlike eyes filled with tears, real tears, no doubt, as she replied, "O Ahensimen, I thought you wouldst ever be the same to me. I thought not that you wouldst keep your anger thus. We parted in anger, it is true, but I thought you was unreasonable in your suspicions, and see, I have wept such bitter tears since you did leave me, without one kiss, and now you art as cold as ice to me. Can it be that you dost love me no more? That you no longer carest for my love since you art become the king?" She looked not like a guilty wife, but like a pleading child as she spoke thus to me, and I had almost begun to believe in her again. I so longed to take her to my heart, and hear her say she loved me. I took a step towards her, and my face softened and my eyes filled with tears. And then, O God, if I have sinned, had I not grave provocation, for there upon the carpet between us lay the king's signet ring, the ring he had given Zuleika, and which she had worn upon her slender finger at the fatal moment when I had seen her in his arms. In the hurry and action, the ring had fallen from Zuleika's finger, which was much too small to wear it, and had lain unnoticed upon the floor to rise up like a silent accusing witness of her falseness and my dishonor. I started as though an adder had stung me, and picked up the ring, and holding it out to her, said, "O, woman, fair and faithless, O smooth-faced liar that you art. You sayest that you wept for my departure, when it was the lover who died even at your feet for whom those tears were shed. If you know nothing of Selim, how comes his ring, his signet ring, within your sleeping chamber? The chamber that should be sacred to you and me alone. Perjure thyself no more. Seek no further to deceive me, for behold, I saw you with him, and I saw him die, even as you did see him die at your feet. Oh, most false of women, who couldst lie in my arms and whisper words of love into mine ears, when you had already deceived and dishonored me? You shall die. Yea, of a truth you shall die, and go to hell to seek for your paramour." I drew my dagger, and would have stabbed her to the heart, but she uttered a piercing cry and fell at my feet, kissing them like a slave, and groveling on the ground in abject terror, while she pleaded for life, only life. Then was my wrath turned to contempt, and I spurned her from me with my foot, and drew my sash, which she had grasped in her agony of fear, away from her hands, as though her touch defiled me. "Your life, vile harlot! What is the value of a life such as your? Your life! Is it so dear a thing to you? Then live till you are old and grey and withered, and all those charms with which you hast beguiled men's hearts are turned to hideousness, and you art known for what you art, a woman without virtue and without shame. Live. Yea, you shall live, but you shall enjoy the fate you and your betrayer planned for me. You shall go to a prison, not to the palace of your dreams." I turned away.